$1.2 billion a year. That's the amount that Our Schools Now advocate. Dr. Rich Kendall says lawmakers have incrementally and gradually removed from Utah public education funding over the past several decades.
To say that they have taken $1.2 billion a year out of school funds, public and higher, not happy. People shouldn't be happy. And one of the great ironies is that this is being cast as a kind of contest or conflict between kids who are the primary beneficiaries, and I mean all up through higher ed, you're the prime beneficiaries, and who are the taxpayers? You are.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a forum on the Our Schools Now ballot initiative that education advocates and Utah business leaders are pushing to increase funding for Utah's public education. That forum is coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Earlier this week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a forum on public education funding in Utah and the proposed Our Schools Now ballot measure for 2018 that policymakers are currently debating during this legislative session. Proponents of Our Schools Now argue that investment in K-12 education in Utah has decreased over the last 20 years, and they say Our Schools Now would give Utahns a chance to vote in 2018 to increase the state income tax by 0.7% in order to invest more in Utah's public schools. It's a movement that's largely supported by business leaders in the state, and if passed, the initiative, they say, would raise an additional $750 million in funding that they say would provide roughly $1,000 per enrolled student, and that most of the additional funding would go towards K-12 education. But recently, leadership in the state legislature, including Speaker of the House Greg Hughes and Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, are opposed to the ballot measure. They think that raising income taxes would hurt Utah's economy. The discussion we're airing today comes largely from supporters of the Our Schools Now initiative, and they'll be responding to lawmakers' concerns. The panelists include Sean Tigan, Research Director for the Utah Foundation, Dr. Rich Kendall, Our Schools Now Executive Committee member, Dr. Suzanne Harrison, she's a former candidate for Utah House District 32, and the conversation was moderated by Allison Nicholson, a Research Associate for the Utah Education Policy Center. Here's Allison.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me here today and give me the opportunity to talk about this important topic and discussion. And I thought I'd just start with a quick background data on Utah school funding to give you all a little bit of context about how we compare to other states. And I pulled the latest figures from the Census Bureau. You've probably all heard that Utah is 51st in funding. So on average, the Census Bureau shows about $6,500 per student in Utah that we spend. And our next closest states are Idaho and Arizona. They're about $6,600, $7,000. And the United States average is up at $11,000. And then when we look at our highest states like New York spending $20,000, or New Jersey and Connecticut around $17,000, and the District of Columbia at $18,000, I just wanted to give you those quick numbers so that you all have a little context of what we're talking about today. So despite that we spend $4.6 billion on our K-12 education and $1.7 billion on higher ed, and that is only 40% of our entire, that accounts for 40% of our budget when you look at all the sources, federal, state, everything. If you just looked at our state taxes, we spend, you know, over half of our budget on these. And despite doing that, we have a large number of children in our schools, and therefore you have that low per pupil funding. So I was asked to introduce our panelists today, and I'm going to start with Mr. Sean Tigan. It's Tigan, right?
Yes.
Mr. Sean Tigan. He's the research director at the Utah Foundation, and they regularly publish research reports on important public policy issues. And Sean recently authored the report, Getting By With Less, Two Decades of K-12 Education Revenue and Spending. He received his undergraduate and graduate degrees here at the University of Utah and manages to also fit in volunteering, including he was a Peace Corps volunteer. Next in the middle is Dr. Rich Kendall, and he's an executive committee member of the group Our Schools Now, and I think he's held every high-level education position I can think of in the state, including he was the superintendent of Davis School District, which is on the K-12 side, and then he was also the commissioner of higher education. He's been the interim president at Southern Utah University, and he was also former Governor Mike Leavitt's education deputy advisor. And he also has master's and PhD degrees from the University of Utah. And on our last panelist here is Dr. Suzanne Harrison. She's an anesthesiologist at Riverton Hospital and chair of that department as well. In 2006, she ran for the Utah House of Representatives in District 34, I believe down in Draper, Sandy area. And she fell just 5 votes short, so it was a very close election. She's a graduate of Stanford University, and her children attend public schools in Draper. And during this campaign, she focused on the need for greater education spending. So it's an honor to have all of you here today. And I thought we'd just start with a little opening statement, give us a little background. Sean, can you give us an overview of the Utah Foundation's research and findings on education funding, specifically that last report that you published on taxing effort?
Certainly. So Utah Foundation has been researching education funding for a lot of years. And one of the things that we've decided to do, and we've been doing for 15 or so years, is to look more at not just to say, hey, we're 51st again, and again, and again, and again, every year we're 51st, but instead say, maybe we should look at some other kind of metric. What's another way of thinking about this education funding issue? And we thought that education funding effort makes a lot of sense. So the way we define effort, and this is a way a lot of people talk about effort for education funding, is how much money are each of us spending per $1,000 of our personal income. And when you look at education funding effort and look back at the 1990s, and this is really the crux of the report, is that in the 90s, we were, in 1995, for instance, we had an effort of 7th in the nation. So we were trying really hard. Only 6 states were trying harder than us to fund K-12 education. We were still 51st in the U.S. in terms of per pupil, but we were trying really hard. Now, 20 years later, we are 37th. So we've slipped down over the years, and that what has eroded away funding is not just one thing or some effort by one group, but it's a lot of small changes and a couple of larger changes over the past 20 years. And one of those big changes you can see in a constitutional amendment that was voted on by people of the state, where K-12 shares funding with higher ed. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about that today. And another big thing was also in the mid-90s were some property tax cuts and also something called truth in taxation that has gradually eroded away some of the funding for K-12 education, which we estimate to be just over $600 million from back in 2006 when you adjust for inflation. And then the last thing are income tax cuts. We had some Huntsman's income tax cuts during the mid-2000s, but also just a small tax cuts and tax relief to folks and organizations over the past 20 years. That's another $350 million or so. So all told, I'll wrap up with just this kind of the way to think about this. In terms of education funding effort, if you just account for the stuff that the state has control over, and by the state government. So they can do things with the state property tax levy that goes toward education, that's property taxes that go toward education. And then there's also, they obviously have control over income taxes. So if you just look at that, and you look back in 1995, when we were 7th in the nation, we were spending about 30, each of us, or our parents, or whomever, per $1,000 of personal income, we were spending about $39. Now we're spending about $28, and so that decrease in per pupil spending equates to about roughly $2,000, a little over $2,000 per student. It's over $1 million per school. So if you can imagine what some of these schools would be doing with $1 million, so the middle school down the street or the elementary school in your neighborhood, there's probably a lot. $1 million can do potentially a lot of good in a small community school like that.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sean. That was a good explanation of a complex topic. Rich, why don't you tell us about our schools now, including who's involved in that and initiative and why you decided to pursue that route?
Our schools now is kind of a business-led initiative, and it's co-chaired by Gail Miller, Scott Anderson, and Ron Jepson, three, I think, very well-known and very well-placed business executives in the state of Utah. We have also assembled 100 others who represent the business committee kind of at large, who feel that the erosion of funding for education is having clear consequences on students, on quality of life, and on our future economy. And I think there has been a resolution that this is bad policy, and we've got to put together a good plan that's well funded that will improve the quality of education in the state of Utah. And I've been at this for a while. It started like a lot of movements start, around a lunch table with Lane Beatty and Natalie Gochner and people like that, saying we need to put together a plan to guide the state for the next several years. And we kind of hatched the idea of Prosperity 2020 and the hope that we would have a much better prepared workforce by 2020. So we have tried to work with the legislature on this agenda. We have been disappointed and came to the conclusion at the end of last year that the legislature simply would not move on the key components of the agenda that we felt was very important. You know, one of the elements of that is, which I think is well known to school people all over the country, if not all over the world, if you're going to make a big improvement in the chances for a young person to do well in school, you've got to start earlier. So we made quite an effort for preschool, voluntary preschool, and voluntary all-day kindergarten as a way of giving populations of young kids in this state a chance to be successful in school, basically school readiness. This has been a theme that's been going on in Utah for probably 15 years. We've hooked up with the Chamber. We've hooked up with the United Way. We've hooked up with Goldman Sachs. We've tried a variety of ways, but we have never been able to crack into the legislature nor the governor in terms of providing funding to some of the most disadvantaged and, in a way, disenfranchised young people in our state. So when it became clear that we were just not going to get there, we decided that we would take this matter directly to the people of Utah and let them decide whether they were willing to pay more in their personal income taxes to fund education. And when I say education, it means pre-K, kindergarten, the elementary grades, the secondary grades, UCAT, and the Utah College of Applied Technology, and also higher education. The money would go directly to the schools. They would have some general guidelines on how to spend it, but the aim of this is to try to improve student achievement, graduation rates, both in secondary education and in higher education, and that we think the net effect of all of that will be a higher quality of life in Utah and a much better prepared workforce. So I think what's really driving this, and I know this is a broad generalization, but I think this is it. Utah, despite all of these claims for being the best economy in the world, and having all of these indicators from Fortune 500 and all of this, the fact is this economy and this tax structure is not producing enough revenue to take care of Utah's basic needs. What are they? Some of them are historic. We need to build roads. There's not enough money to build roads. We need to build water infrastructure. We don't have money to do it. We need to greatly improve public and higher education. We don't have the money to do it. I was doing really well today until I walked outdoors and took a couple of deep breaths and realized I'm in Utah. I've just spent the last week in Los Altos, California, and I didn't get quite enough of that clean air from California. We have not moved on it in a significant way. We have other problems as well. But at the end of the day, Utah does not have enough revenue to take care of the basic challenges facing us. Now, what the legislature has done to deal with this, and I'll make this fast, they have not funded growth in higher education for at least 30 years. So how do you pay for higher education? How many of you are students? You're paying for it. That tax has been shifted to you in tuition. And it's been an ongoing phenomenon. They did not have enough money to build roads, and they didn't want to raise the gas tax. So where did they go? They took the money directly out of school funds to build roads in Utah County. That's how they did it. Now they're faced with water infrastructure, and they're talking about taking money out of the road fund to take care of water infrastructure in the state. So it's just a chess game of moving money around to what seems to be the biggest need, but education has not been one of them. And the sad truth is, as your report shows, virtually all of the tax cuts that have been made over the last 10 to 12 years, all of it has come out of education. So the business community is going to try and reverse that. Take it right to the public and say, are you willing to raise your taxes for better schools? And that's it. I think I'm done.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we're airing a forum recorded earlier this week about the Our Schools Now initiative that Utah legislators and education policymakers are debating now. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and forums held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited in their entirety as a public service. And today we are airing a forum recorded earlier this week on the Our Schools Now initiative. It's a ballot measure for 2018 that, if passed by voters, would increase state income tax by 0.7% in order to invest more in Utah public schools. Supporters of the initiative point to polls showing that most Utahns would support such a tax increase if it were to help improve public education performance for Utah school children. But they're facing resistance from state lawmakers who worry that an income tax increase would hurt Utah's economy. The panelists include Dr. Sean Tigan, he's a research director for the Utah Foundation, also Dr. Rich Kendall, Our Schools Now Executive Committee member, Dr. Suzanne Harrison, she's a former candidate for Utah House District 32, and the conversation is moderated by Alice Nicholson, she's a research advocate for the Utah Education Policy Center.
Let's see, now let's have Dr. Harrison talk about her experiencing kind of at the grassroots level, running this recent campaign that she did. And you made education and education funding a central theme of your campaign. And what were you hearing from voters and constituents about this?
Having just run in 2016, this is an issue that voters care about. I knocked on thousands of doors and talked to thousands of people, and it's clear. And it's one of the reasons I ran for office, is my daughter had 29 children in her kindergarten class, and in a state that talks about valuing education and talks about how much we love our families, we are selling our kids' futures short. And that is what compelled me to run for office, in addition to some clean air issues and some other transparency issues in government. But in talking to voters, these families are ready for this to be a priority, and not just to have our elected officials talk about this issue and give lip service to it. we're ready for actual action and commitment and have this be a priority. We have some of the largest class sizes in the country. We have a severe teacher shortage that this legislature was warned about over a decade ago. And yet we have a series of inaction and barely keeping up with student enrollment growth and new student growth that has happened, and we've got to make this a priority for our kids' futures. My husband's a computer programmer, works for a small startup down in South Jordan, and these companies, these high-tech companies in these high-paying jobs that we want to come to Utah, they can't fill the positions that they have in CS, in STEM, all these high-paying jobs. We're not training our kids to fill these jobs, and we've got to focus on making this a priority.
Okay, thanks. So maybe you know our schools now, and Rich explained this, is an initiative where they want to raise the income tax, which is currently 5%, so they raise that to 5.875%, is that correct? And then that new money would be targeted to schools, and there's some stipulations on how that can be spent. And I understand that the new funding is supposed to be used in ways that directly relate to student achievement improvement in certain areas. So I want to ask the panel about how they would respond to the claim that you hear often that, you know, just more money is not the answer. So, Rich, do you want to start?
I think we agree that, you know, throwing money at a problem is not an effective way of seeking a solution. But we also know that the schools are dramatically underfunded and that there are some things that can be done that would make our schools better. I'll mention just four or five, and these are all included in the legislation that we would put forward. A school could develop a student achievement plan at their local school level. It would fit within the broad parameters established by their local district so that they're not working at odds with each other. The money could be spent on early education. So I've heard from some schools already who say, we will start a high quality early learning program in four or five schools where we have a lot of poverty, a lot of kids who don't speak English with facility, and who are not going to do well in school, at least based on our predictions. Others are going to move to all-day kindergarten as a way of enriching the curriculum. Much more needs to be done in helping young people just becoming literate. And we set a goal, or at least the state did several years ago, of getting to 90% literacy. But whether you look at the National Assessment of Educational Progress or whether you look at the SAGE scores, less than half of our third graders are at proficiency. They're just not meeting the standard. So it's almost laughable to think that we're going to get them to 90%. But if a student has not done well by the third or fourth grade, there's a lot of research that says they're going to have difficulty in school. And that doesn't mean they're destined not to do well, but it certainly helps if you read and write and can do mathematics with facility by those early grades. And hopefully you'll have a thrill in what happens to you in an elementary classroom. So I just came back from Los Altos, and I'm sorry for this little anecdote, but my little 9-year-old grandson, who's in a regular public school there, rushed up to me with a little gift, and he said, I'd like you to see this. This is my latest project. And it was a custom-made case for my iPhone, made out of graphite that he designed and printed on a 3D printer in his classroom. I just thought, I can't believe it. I just can't believe it. But that's the kind of quality opportunities that young people are getting in that particular school system. So we need to spend much more money on teachers. We have neglected teachers. We have not helped to provide career pathways for teachers that are more rewarding. I think the legislature is guilty of disrespecting teachers in many ways. And we've kicked that can down the road for as long as I can remember. well, isn't it too bad that we can't get better people to go into education? We've got to give it some serious attention, and one of the elements of our schools now is that 25% of the money can be used for teacher salaries and salary-driven benefits. When you get all the numbers computed, it turns out to be about a 5% to 6% increase in their salaries. That's not going to do it. But many teachers will have preparation days that are fully paid. They will have extended contracts that are fully paid that will take them through the summer. Many teachers will have the option for a 9-month contract, a 10-month contract, an 11-month contract, and to do the kinds of things that they enjoy doing as teachers. So that would be true for higher education as well. The University of Utah, if this passes, will get a check every year for $24 million. And I think higher education has said we'll spend this on students. By and large, yes, we'll use some of it for faculty, but we need more financial aid for students. We need to moderate tuition. We need to have more opportunities in key occupations. So we're going to need more faculty and facilities. So they very clearly are on tune, I think, to help drive Utah's economy. So our school now, we believe that the magic dust or the magic juice, if there is any, is talent. The state's got to develop and manage talent. It's not roads. It's not infrastructure. And it's not tax rates. It's what do you do to get the best people, whether they're in the arts, the performing arts, whether they're in technology, science, or medicine. How do we get them to come here and stay here? That's the big challenge.
Okay.
Long answer, sorry.
No problem. Suzanne, did you get any pushback from talking to either voters or constituents or even local school leaders that I'm sure you spoke a lot with about, I just really don't know where the money goes, or is this really going to fix the problem? Was there a lot of consensus on there just needs to be a lot more money or how it needed to be spent?
I think there's some confusion out there about where money goes. I think there's a lot of misperceptions that somehow Utah spends exorbitant amounts of money on administration and administrative tasks. And that's, if you look at compared to other states, we're actually second to the last in terms of administrative spending and administrative costs in the whole country. The only state that spends less is Hawaii, and the reason for that is they are one school district, and we obviously have more than one school district, so that accounts for those costs. We're actually very efficient in terms of administrative costs. I think there's confusion, too, about, you know, I think if people felt like they could understand and have a transparent viewing of where the money goes, I think that would improve people's willingness to spend more on education. I should add, I am not a spokesperson for our schools now. I am a person that got involved with running and ran for the legislature because of this issue and because of what I saw in my kids' schools and my kids' classes and my neighbors' concerns. So I as a person that just ran, I think our legislature spends a lot of money on things that as a parent and as a person that values education, I don't know that reflects my values. The $53 million in a private developer coal port in Oakland is a perfect example of this. I wish that kind of money would stay locally and help our kids and help our schools address class size, address these shortages that we see. And for example, back to school night at my child's elementary school, they told us they have to be really careful with a copy machine this year because they just don't have enough money to pay for the paper to fill the copy machine. And these are the kind of stories that if you ask any parent or ask any teacher, we do not have enough funding for the basic needs of our schools and our kids. And I think it really impacts their future possibilities. And it's an economic development issue, as Dr. Kendall illustrated.
Right. And that kind of leads into, I was going to talk next about, ask you guys about economic development and The other main criticism that I've heard from the legislators or the governor is about, the mechanism to do this. If you get more money into schools, do you raise the income tax rate? Do you try to make sales tax? Do you try to bring in other taxing revenue? And they believe that raising the income tax would be bad for Utah's economy or economic development. At least that's what I've heard. Sean, you probably looked at income tax and property tax, and I wondered if you wanted to talk at all about what has happened by these income tax changes or property tax changes. Have you noticed districts putting more, raising property tax rates, or have all revenues been going down? Income tax versus property tax versus general sales tax being used for other things. How did that tax mix affect come out in your reporting, your research?
So I guess when you look at, in terms of the tax mix, there are districts out there that are not taxing as much as they could for property taxes. And that's one argument where people say, you know what, we don't need to increase the income tax. We don't need to raise the income tax, or we don't need to bring in other revenue because these districts aren't doing it themselves. They're not taxing at the full extent that they can. And I think that is just that in part might be just a result of truth in taxation. And I don't know how much detail we want to get in on that, but it's basically. It's a mechanism by which it's a downward pressure on taxes, so that your tax amount, even if you have a piece of property that doubles in value, the tax amount stays the same. So in essence, you're lowering your property tax. And then if you want to increase taxes, you have to go out and send out a notice and say, hey, you guys, we're going to raise your taxes. Even if it's not really a tax raise, even if it's keeping the rate the same, we have to call it a tax raise, and we're gonna raise your taxes. So come and yell at us for the next 2 hours while we try to get a little bit more property tax from you. So I mean that is part of one of the reasons why maybe districts aren't taxing as high as they could. But in terms of the mix, like there has you can see that with increasing incomes, we have an increasing amount of money that goes into education. So if you want, one thing that the governor says, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'll paraphrase some words in his mouth. Basically, one of the things he says is that, you know, with if you increase taxes, then businesses aren't going to come here, and we're going to have this kind of smaller pool to work with. Which, you know, might be true. If you have no income tax and you have a company saying, should I go to this place with no income tax or a place with 25% income tax? I'll go to the place with no income tax. Maybe that's what would kind of tip the balance for some people. These are all kind of these marginal amounts for the most part. So if you increase income tax a little bit or decrease a little bit, how big of an effect does that really have? Part of the argument for the income tax cuts in 2007 was that it was going to bring in all these businesses. And maybe that's true. It's hard to say. We had this economic recession, and it's hard to say for sure. But one thing you can say, I think, and this is to go back to the question you asked previously, one thing you can say is that some amount of money put into a specific use can have a positive effect in a school. That's the same thing I was saying with a 0 or 25% income tax. If you have no money in a school, obviously you're not going to have any teachers. You know, you're going to have some serious problems. If you're going to have a lot of money, you'll have a lot of money that you can use on a lot of different things. There's probably somewhere some sweet spot, and it might not be 51st in per pupil spending in the United States. There's a researcher, a professor at Stanford, that is often cited and says, his work says, you know what, amount of money per pupil just doesn't matter. It doesn't really have a big effect on maybe a little bit here and there, but overall it's not that big of an effect. The problem is, that is looking at the United States of America. We are a state that spends $6,500 per kid, and we are at the bottom of the pack. And it's quite possible that if we were at $16,500, that $1,000 one way or another per kid wouldn't make that big of a difference. But when you're at $6,500, $1,000 might be the thing that really turns a school around. If you look at Northwest Middle School, this is in Salt Lake City School District, And Northwest did what kind of the program that Rich Kendall's, that our school's now initiative proposes to do, where Northwest wrote a grant and they asked the federal government for some money. And they got $2.3 million to spend over 3 years. And they basically had to say to the federal government, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do this, this, and this, and this. And one of the things was to make sure more money went into the pockets of teachers. And it was performance pay, which for a lot of people, that gets a lot of people's hackles up, and they don't want to talk about performance pay. And performance pay sucks, and it's bad for teachers, and it's bad for morale. Well, a lot of the money there went to performance pay, and it worked for Northwest Middle School. You saw Secretary of Education Arne Duncan at the time came to Northwest and was like, oh my God, like what are you, like this is amazing. You guys went in a couple of years from, and Rich was talking about proficiency earlier, 37% proficiency for mathematics, and you guys have gone up to 78? Like, how is that even possible? There was also a big increase in science. I can't remember what the increase was in reading. But these are, this kind of stuff matters. It probably matters if we raised our income tax by 10%. That would probably turn some people off and be like, oh, all right, we're done. We're not going to Utah. But if we raise it a bit and we put a little bit of money into education and we aren't at the bottom of the pack and we don't have this kind of, we have a notoriety for being not very concerned about education. If we do a little bit around that, it's possible that some of these businesses will be like, you know what? So the income tax has been increased a little bit, but at least they're not like at the bottom of the pack anymore. And at least they have pretty good outcomes, but maybe if we have better outcomes, we'll end up with some more economic growth based upon that. Anyway, that was kind of a long-winded, circuitous answer, but overall, money matters, it matters in economic development, and it matters in schools, and they have there's some balance somewhere, and being 51st might not be where we want to be. It's hard to say.
Looks like Suzanne wants to add on to that.
Yeah, along those lines, I met an executive on the campaign trail in my district who has an international company who has an incredibly difficult time recruiting people to come to Utah to work for her company because they get online, they read about our crummy air and our so-so schools, and they're like, oh, that's going to be another, you know, $45,000 I'd have to pay to put my kid in private schools to even, you know, have a decent chance for my kid for their future, and they won't come here because of these issues. It has real impact on our ability to attract and retain high-quality jobs, high-quality talent, and I think it takes an investment in elementary school level all the way through higher ed to fix this.
Sure, okay. Let's see, Rich, do you want to respond about local school districts maybe exhausting all their property tax effort before the state raises its income tax? Or how do you respond to that criticism that raising the income tax would be bad for the economy in Utah?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be bad for the economy in Utah. And I think it's just conjecture that it would. I don't think it's the biggest factor in the range of things that corporations look at in terms of relocation. On the other matter, I think local schools should make the effort, and many of them do. But there are kind of two Utahs. There's the Utah that we're sitting in here in Salt Lake City, where they do a good job of managing that money. But you go out to Price today and try to raise property taxes in a very depressed economy like in Price or in Emory County, you're going to have a very difficult time doing that. They're depressed. I was acting president at Southern Utah University, and we did a survey down there to find out if we met the poverty standards to qualify for new market tax credits, and we did. Iron County is a poor county. I think one of the realities that Utah just can't quite get is that we remain a low-wage state. We are a low-wage state. We have not attracted our share, if there is such a thing, of high-paying jobs. We're great at distribution centers, We're great at call centers. We're great in the nutraceutical industries, but they're all $14, $15 an hour. I remember when the largest pig farm in the Western United States went out to Milford, it was going to be, if you can stretch with this, a renaissance of pig farm operations. They pay their people $12 an hour. That's how they do it. We're a low-wage state. And to make it something better than a high wage, to get to high wages, you got to have better trained and better educated people. And it's a task. It takes time. It takes slowly. Some of you here, how many are here in accounting, for example? Anybody here?
Accounting.
Okay. You're in accounting. You know, the school here is a wonderful school of accountancy. If you get a master's degree in accountancy here or at BYU, you're going to have a chance for a really first-rate job. But where will it be? Go with Ernst & Young. Where are you going to be? Probably going to be in Los Angeles. You're probably going to be in Chicago. You're not going to find that high-level accounting career in Utah. That's part of the problem. So, some of my colleagues are here, and I want to use all of my teaching skills. So, I don't know where the camera is, but I didn't bring my little nifty pen. But that's the question of the day for the camera. Where's the $1.2 billion? We are missing that amount every year from the Uniform School Fund. $1.2 billion every year from the Uniform School Fund. Is it any wonder they don't have paper? Heaven help them if the machine breaks. Yeah. Is it any wonder that we have class sizes that sometimes get up to 29, 30, 31, 32? Is it any wonder that we don't have the kind of sophisticated scientific equipment in our high schools that they need? Where's the $1.2 billion every year? So that's the big issue. I won't be able to go within 400 yards of the Capitol for the remainder of the session. But that's all right. It makes them mad. And I went up a week ago and gave a little pitch and said, you know, there's some positive things that the state could do to make a teaching more attractive. There are things that you could do that would make kids in the first, second, and third grades do better with reading, more individual attention. And I said, these are things that are not going to break the bank, but they're things that you could do. So I got a call the next day from a good friend at the Senate who said, wow, you are toxic. You better not come back here. I said, okay, if that's the label I've got to have, to tell the truth, that's the label I've got to have. Very sensitive. So to say that they have taken $1.2 billion a year out of school funds, public and higher, not happy. People shouldn't be happy. And one of the great ironies is that this is being cast as a kind of contest or conflict between kids who are the primary beneficiaries, and I mean all up through higher ed, you're the prime beneficiaries. And who are the taxpayers? You are, your parents, your grandparents, and others in Utah that are also beneficiaries of a highly educated citizenry. So I know I'm going to vote for my grandkids. I'm going to vote for my kids. And I hope the rest of Utah says, my grandkids are worth it. I have a strange addiction. I still go to tax hearings. Don't ask me why. I cannot explain it, but I go to tax hearings, and here's what I find so funny. I sit next to some codger that's my age, and he is there to say, I absolutely oppose any form of tax increase. And he sits down, he's all angry and all upset, and I say, John, how many children do you have? 7. How many grandchildren do you have in the public schools? 32. Who's paying for those children, John? They're your kids. Not me. I'm not. I don't want to pay for them. So that's the irony that we're faced with. We've gotten away with it for a while, but we're ready to take it to the public and ask, do you want to invest in your kids? Do you want to invest in their education? Let's get out of an economy that's 30 years old. Let's get into the world and the economy that we live in now. And it's high skill and high education. And if you don't have that, that's what's happened in the middle class. It's gone.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a forum recorded earlier this week on the proposed Our Schools Now ballot initiative. If passed by voters, it would increase the state income tax by 0.7% and would raise an additional $750 million a year to invest more in Utah's public schools, mostly for K-12 education. Supporters say most polls show that Utahns support this initiative or would support it, but many state lawmakers are opposed to raising income taxes to fund education. The panel participants in this conversation are Sean Tigan, he's with the Utah Foundation, Dr. Rich Kendall, Our School's Now Executive Committee member, Dr. Suzanne Harrison, she's a former candidate for the state legislature, House District 32, and the conversation was moderated by Allison Nicholson, she's with the Utah Education Policy Center.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, taking it to the public specifically. And I know I've seen polling numbers that show overwhelming support from Utahns for they support more money in public education, and they even support a tax increase. But you all know we've seen some surprises in polling lately, namely Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. I'd like to ask the panelists if they think we could see something similar here. You know, how concerned are you that voters say they support this? Who's going to be against the kids? But when they actually get in the voting booth, are they going to vote to increase their taxes? Suzanne, do you want to answer that? What do you think?
I think the voters are frustrated. I think that for years and years, the polls have shown that parents care about the quality of the education for their kids. Teachers are suffering and being squeezed in every area. And as a parent of kids in public schools, I'm frustrated that my multiple attempts to reach out to elected officials have fallen on deaf ears. That's partly why I ran for office. But I'm grateful to the business community for being organized and really applying pressure on our elected officials, because quite frankly, I think that's one of the few groups that elected officials listen to. And I think, you know, parents, I don't know, have the same clout or the same big donor pockets to be listened to, like the business community. So I'm grateful to them for prioritizing this and being organized. And if our elected officials aren't going to prioritize this and rearrange funds to prioritize what matters to the voters, I'm grateful to the business community for putting pressure on it and taking it to the voter to have it answered. Heaven knows they've tried to work with the legislature in the past.
Rich,
it's a big lift.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's a huge lift, and I think we're going to have to mobilize a lot of people who are going to have to see the value of doing it. It's a huge lift, and we know that, but we think it's the only way that we're going to make headway. The thing that worries me the most is that this will turn into a highly politicized campaign, and the Koch brothers will be in town running it with their billions of ultra-right-wing propaganda. And that's going to be difficult to deal with. So we know that they're already gearing up for this fight. They have almost unlimited resources. We're going to have to appeal to Utahns everywhere to say, this is good for you, it's good for your kids, for your family, and ultimately for the state of Utah. Now, whether people will really do that or not is a big lift, but we're going to give it our best shot, and we'll see. The polling has been extremely positive, and even when we have put a number with it, would you be willing to pay $400, $500, it's been positive. We have a new poll that will be coming out in the next week I don't know exactly what it says, but I'm hoping that people that are faced with a $500 or $600 bill on their taxes will say, my kids, my community, my family, this state is worth it. And we can't just keep kicking this can down the road.
Okay.
I'm starting to sound like a legislator. Hit the can down the road. Don't throw money at a problem. Maybe I'll run for office. I've got all the slogans.
You should run.
Yeah.
Well, so in response to your initiative and announcing this initiative, legislators have come out and, I don't know if it's on the defensive, but they've come out to say, okay, we will do something. We don't think it's the income tax, but
it's defensive.
We can put the sales tax back on food, or we can collect online sales tax. Or do you feel like there's anything, is there a scenario that the response from the legislature is going to be sufficient enough for you to say, okay, that, thank you for finally listening and doing something. We're going to suspend the initiative.
We've met with leadership on both sides of the aisle, and our meetings have been polite, and all parties have been attentive. My opinion is, after coming out of there, that the likelihood of getting a legislative solution is not very good. And there are so many needs in the state. Let's say that somebody made the comment, let's take the sales tax off food and put it all into early education. You know, that would be a good thing to do. And the minute those words escaped that person's mouth, hands went up everywhere. Nope, we've got 10 other things that need to be done. And that's the nature of legislation. Everybody will have their hand out. And the likelihood of that getting earmarked for education is not good at all.
Okay.
And there probably will be, I mean, there has been new money into education over the past number of years. If you look at, some lawmakers say, over the past 5 years, we've put $1.8 billion into education. But when you unpack that a little bit and you see that, okay, that means K-12 and higher ed. Oh, and that means they're covering from the new kids. And that doesn't account for inflation. That $1.8 billion is more like $20 to $30 million. And it's not 1.8 billion, it's 20 to 30 million a year, which doesn't go a long ways when you got 1,000 schools that you're divvying up that money between. So there may be some more money this year, and at the end that everybody's gonna pat themselves on the back, and we've done this thing, we put money into education again. But the cynic in me kind of says that it's gonna be it's going to be an amount that gets gobbled up by growth and of student population and inflation, and at the end of the day, there's not a lot of money there. Whereas our schools now it's a lot of money. There's a lot of money that they're proposing.
Well, we may actually have, been responsible for one of those unintended consequences, because they are angry and they are upset. It's kind of like, we'll show you. And, it might be counterproductive that we're out trying to do this, and I hope not. I mean, one of the best things that could happen is that the legislature would continue to fund the WPU at roughly 2% a year. They would fully fund growth, and then this other money would go to real programmatic improvements to make our state much more competitive in the world. But
okay. Well, I probably am supposed to leave some time for audience questions, right? So everybody think of a question. Please wait for the mic and tell us your name and a little bit about yourself. We have one right here in the front.
My name is Ron White, and I'm here to support Utah kids and grandkids. The governor in particular, but the legislature also, are working the old horse that the only way we'll possibly survive poor Utah is if we keep the taxes low so that people will want to continue to come here. And I believe that old horse is worn out and ready for the glue factory. The fact is, that we are now seeing more people, as Dr. Harrison suggested, who are not coming here because of a variety of social issues, but most particularly the state of our education. We saw this morning in the Wall Street Journal reported that 79% of the electrical engineering graduate students in America and 71% of the computer science graduate students in America are foreign-born because of the utter failure of American STEM education. So my question is, if Eric Hanushek, who's the Stanford product and the world's foremost expert on the economy of education, is telling us that the growth of countries is tied to their educational performance, and we are at number 36 in the PISA math tests, for example. How can they possibly argue that?
Who wants to take that one?
Well, it's a national problem. If you look at the TIM scores, you look at the PISA scores, our rankings are not good. And it should be a national alarm. I guess it's a nation at risk for the sake of going back 30 years. We're not going to risk anymore. That was a long time ago. The difficulty I think we've had is that there are 100 good ideas, but we can't get money to sustain them over time. The legislature created a STEM center in the state, and one of its functions was to create new standards for STEM teachers and to provide them with the training so they could be effective with those new STEM standards. Their funding has already been cut. So a two-year jolt, a three-year jolt, and then back away, let's move on to some other new idea. I think we were told for years that if you can introduce more competition, and Jeb Bush came out here and talked about Florida and all the wonderful things they were doing by grading schools. But we don't have any evidence at all, thanks in part to Andrea Rohr's shop, can't help but draw you in, that charter schools, if they are promoting competition, it certainly hasn't boosted anybody. And the charter schools themselves are doing about the same as public schools, maybe a little less. Their scores are not as good as the public schools. So that's a failed effort. It's made people happy, and I understand the value of choice. But as a remedy, it's not a remedy to really improve our school system. So we've had Hanushek out here. He's a very smart guy, has some great ideas and recommendations, but two or three of them will say, if you really want to have a robust school system, I just read Tom Friedman's article about Shanghai schools. You got to start early. You need preschool. You need all-day kindergarten. And you need the best people in education you can possibly afford. And we tried to solve it with technology. The technology gets out of date. It just hasn't provided a solution. The real key, I'm taking way too much time, but I chaired the Governor's Commission on the core curriculum and on both math and the English language arts side. The thing that came out of this was that the standards were much, much better than the old standards. But both chairs said the key to real success with the new standards is having highly qualified people. That's the key. I agree. So we're going to put all the money over in the School of Education, and things will be good.
That's right. Looks like we have a couple more questions.
Hello, I'm Carly. I'm a student here. I'm studying urban ecology and strategic communications. I was wondering what you think about the initiative to kind of grandfather in, so to speak, people who haven't been through the declaration of I'm going to be a secondary school, like the meeting the curriculum. I don't know how to word this because I forget the name, but I read somewhere that we're so desperate for teachers in Utah that if you pass a specific content test, then you can become a teacher. I was wondering what the name of that is called, because I'm forgetting, and what your thoughts are.
It's the APT, the Academic APT. Pathway to Teaching.
Okay. Does that concern
that,
you?
The alternative route to teaching.
ARL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a response. It's a response to a problem that's much bigger than this, and it's not a good response. The teachers that I know that are really good, really successful at working with kids, have developed their craft over a long period of time. And they've had some failures and they've had some successes. But you don't turn a teacher out overnight just because they have an engineering degree. And it's one of the false assumptions that we've made. Oh, you teach mathematics? Or you are a math with L3 communications? You automatically will be a proficient math teacher. It doesn't work that way. And many of the people that start with these alternate routes don't last very long. They just don't connect with kids. There are a variety of reasons. But these are short-term, knee-jerk responses that are not good. Not good policy.
Let's see. Let's take one more quick question right here.
So you talked about making teaching as a profession more attractive to graduates or to people who are looking at the profession. But at least in STEM, you're never going to make the pay competitive of what you can get in the private sector, right? If you graduate with a degree in electrical engineering, you can get five times as much what you can get as a public school teacher. So you're never going to raise that to be on par. So what are other ways to make teaching attractive to potential teachers?
Rich was talking about Andrew Rorschach and kind of the work that these guys do, and they've done some work in this area, but there are, money helps a little bit, but there are things where you're empowering teachers within a system so that they are not basically a silo in a class with their kids, but are working together with people across the school and have maybe. You're empowering them to do a little bit more in the school, and to also make sure that they've got the time to adequately prepare for classes, and make sure that they are they've got the time to interact with other teachers to see which students maybe need additional help, or to get a little bit more information about incoming classes and problems that they're maybe having with students. Whereas right now, I mean, maybe if you are squeezed for time and you don't have that extra time, and there's work being done there already. I mean, there are already these kind of collective groups within schools, but if you have more of that, that does help make it a more attractive profession.
And you're right, money is important, but support is important, and the leadership is very important. It's more than just money. And you're right, they'll never be able to compete with the private sector. And so those things that Sean mentioned, including support and giving teachers what they need and having important leaders is very important within the school.
And a robust professional development but there are some tools out there that help, but a lot of them take a little bit of money to really
sure.
enact.
And I think, you know, we talk a lot about money, but I think we've also squeezed the joy out of teaching and for some of our kids, the joy out of learning. And I think money can't solve everything, but money can, for example, in my school district, they have a real need for music in the elementary school, and they can't afford to have programs in all these schools. There's a real need for computer science teachers, and it's not all about salary. If we had less micromanaging of education, less micromanaging of testing and how our kids are performing, I think that more folks would come to teaching if it had the respect that it deserves. They're true professionals, and we need the best and the brightest inspiring our kids for the futures that we want for our kids.
I'm sure we could go on with so much more discussion and question, but we've ran out of time, so I'd ask you to join me in thanking our guests for this interesting and informative forum.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.